Hello there, and welcome to Ask Dr. Dawn. I'm Dr. Dawn Motika, your host for this hour of medical news, debate, discussion, healthcare and science in the news, and answers to your questions either by phone or by email. Yes, it's another hour of Ask Dr. Dawn. Before we go any further, I need to remind you that the opinions expressed on this program represent those of the speakers, and not necessarily those of this station, its staff, or its contributors. Furthermore, the purpose of this program is education and entertainment. It is not intended as a substitute for professional consultation. So I thought I'd start out the year with a new feature, Health Tip of the Week. And your Health Tip of the Week today is a homework assignment. Spend 2 minutes by the clock listening to a bird sing. There's a lot of that going around right now this morning. Birdsong has, I think, a fundamentally resonant thing going on in human physiology. A little factoid for you to support this rather woo-woo, new wave, fuzzy studies kind of statement. A conference I went to a couple of years ago discussing sound pointed out a rather interesting fact. Plants have these things called somata, which are how they absorb oxygen and release oxygen and absorb carbon dioxide. They're on the bottoms of the leaves. They are closed overnight, and in the morning, they open up. It turns out that it's not sunrise that signals them to open, so much it is sound at a certain pitch, the pitch made by birds. And researchers used recordings of bird songs and also synthetic versions in similar frequencies and showed that you could cause the somata on the bottom of the leaves to open up by themselves on demand just with sound signaling. And I think there's something in us similar perhaps to a mouth that opens up to receive nourishment or oxygen that opens when we hear bird songs. So give it a try. Consider it a homework assignment and see what you think. Health tip for the day. I had a really interesting story that I wanted to share with you for starters. And it's really almost on the edge between something the geeks might talk about on Geek Speak and something medical. One of the problems with drugs in general is the fact that they get eliminated from the body very quickly. So there's all sorts of strategies for trying to get them to hang around in the bloodstream longer. And that includes, for example, using an injection or a patch or something that's going to diffuse slowly into the bloodstream so that the liver won't be able to get to and detoxify that substance very quickly. And if you don't know what we mean by detoxification, let me point you to the AskDrDawn.com website and the archived interviews with Dr. Jeffrey Bland on detoxification. It's a fascinating topic, and it's also very, very important to understand for a lot of reasons. But getting back to the scientific breakthrough here, researchers at the University of North Carolina at Chapel Hill have actually figured out a way to make a synthetic cell. It's really a synthetic red blood cell, but they're not using it to carry oxygen. Their idea is that they might be able to use it to carry drugs and have them hang around in the system for longer. The researchers printed these things out on effectively a kind of computer printer. They used hydrogel, which is a gel-like substance that is silicon-based and soft, and you might remember that as the compound that's found in diapers or the compound that you put in with your soil when you're putting in a plant that you want to be able to not water all the time. These particles absorb water and then release it, but they could also release drugs. So the trick is getting a particle that's small enough that it's going to mimic red blood cells. In other words, be small enough to squeeze through the capillaries and circulate and not be taken out of circulation by the spleen, which ordinarily filters any red blood cell that's too stiff or lacks flexibility. Other particles as well, immune complexes are filtered by the spleen and the reticuloendothelial system. So bypassing that filter and being able to put something in the bloodstream and have it hang around for a while is a really significant major breakthrough. And the fact that these things are created essentially by a hydrogel being put through a printer and out come these little 6-micron particles, which can then be infused, hydrated and infused into the bloodstream. Now, right now they're working in mice, but they got the particles to hang out in the bloodstream for weeks. The most flexible ones had a half-life of 94 hours, which is long enough that you could start contemplating loading some chemical or drug into that and having it hang around. I could see this with lots of implications for cancer and for other sorts of autoimmune disease. Anything that's related to the immune system could conceivably be influenced this way. And it's just a brand new thing, a new technology, a new concept, really, in medicine. And I'm finding it very exciting and cool. So I'm all geeked out this morning. The planned interview on detoxification is in the April 22nd, 2006 show. That's in the archives. And I would encourage anyone to listen to that, even if you heard it back in 2006, because it definitely bears listening to more than once. Now, on not so happy a note, we're currently experiencing a outbreak of Kawasaki disease in the San Francisco Bay Area. We can maybe expect that this could happen here. It's Kawasaki disease is a reportable disease. It is a unknown caused vasculitis, an infectious inflammation, maybe infectious, certainly occurs in outbreaks of inflammation of the blood vessels. And it is an important disease to be aware of. It's the kind of thing that in medical school, one learns about it and then promptly forgets about it because it's rare to see a case. But for those of you who are healthcare practitioners and listeners and just those interested in the community, I'm going to run down the criteria real quick for you. Kawasaki syndrome can damage the heart. It can cause aneurysms and even death in the blood vessels of the heart. So we want to be sure that we identify a case and get these children on intravenous immunoglobulin and aspirin, which turns out to drastically reduce the chances of long-term vascular damage. So what we're looking for is 5 days of fever, large lymph nodes, conjunctivitis or pink eye, along with redness or swelling of the hands and a red rash. So if you see red and swelling hands and pink eye and fever, you should be going to look up the rest for Kawasaki syndrome. These are not what you typically see with fever. Fever, pink eyes, redness and swelling of the hands. There are also characteristic findings in the mouth, and that was always played up a lot in medical school. But I find that the red mouth, red lips, strawberry tongue that's part of the description of Kawasaki's overlaps too much with strep and other common illnesses to be useful as an identifier. But the red swollen hands and the 5 days of fever, that's a big deal. So anyone meeting these criteria needs to be brought to the attention of the appropriate pediatric infectious disease people and of the alert. One last really interesting news story. Women's tears of sadness lower testosterone in men. Now, this is just one of the most amazing studies. It was published in Science this week, and it's a new finding, a scientific discovery, a true one. It's been known for a while that some mice have a pheromone that's released in the tears. So these researchers decided to look for pheromones in human tears, and they used women. The way they obtained emotional tears was to show women really sad movies. These were lab volunteers, and they watched a really sad movie, and as they cried, they collected their tears. And then for the control group, they had women who didn't watch a sad movie and had salt water dripped down their cheeks so that the salt water was collected, I should say, in the same way. Then other male volunteers sniffed the tears to see if they could detect a difference between emotional tears and plain old salt water drip down the cheek. No difference, undetectable. But is there a pheromone? Well, apparently. For one thing, when men who had sniffed the sad tears looked at photographs of attractive women, they rated women less attractive if they'd been sniffing the sad tears. Furthermore, when the men were scanned inside a brain MRI machine, the neural networks associated with sexual arousal were less active. And here's the topper. The men tested out as having less testosterone in their saliva after sniffing the emotionally sad tears. So, guys, when a woman cries, it really does break you up inside, drops your testosterone, and makes you more likely, I guess, to comfort her and less likely to try to seduce her. Fascinating. Just fascinating. And let's go to our first caller. It's Pete in Santa Cruz. Hello, Pete, and welcome to the program.
Hello.
Hello.
Good morning. It's pretty crazy about the tears.
Isn't that wild?
Amazing. Hey, I have two quick questions, and I'll take the answers off the air.
Okay.
First one's about smegma. For those of us that are uncircumcised, there's like a buildup. First day is like a little filmy, and the second day more filmy. And then, like, if you're backpacking or something after 3 or 4 days, it's definitely a solid kind of a white,
material. Yeah, material.
So I'm wondering if that's something. And as I'm 62 now, and it seems like it's building up. Maybe it's because I'm not taking as many showers or whatever. But anyway, I'm 20. Is that something I need to consciously clean every day, other than smelling really bad? Is it something that's harmful? The second question is what's commonly known as pre-cum. You know, if you're engaged in foreplay and the kind of clear substance that comes out, can someone get pregnant from that?
Okay, let me two very good questions. Thank you for asking them.
All right.
I'll take the second one first. The answer to the pre-cum, these are secretions from Cowper's glands, which are in the male urethra, and they are chock full of sperm. So yes, indeed, anything that comes out of a penis that's liquid can probably make you pregnant, out of the tip anyway. And the second topic, if I can rephrase your question, it's if I don't clean this stuff off from under my foreskin, am I going to make myself sick? Am I going to hurt myself? Is it just a cosmetic issue? And in my considered medical opinion, it's a cosmetic issue. The secretions are largely, well, it's a combination of oil and sebum, which is a waxy substance produced by glands. There are some apocrine secretions, which are hormonal in nature, similar to sweat, but a modified type of sweat gland. Call it a musk. And finally, dead skin cells. And the bulk of the material is, in fact, exfoliated epithelial cells, which, if you have a foreskin, are trapped and have nowhere to go. We lose cells from the surface of our skin constantly. We're constantly sloughing. But the cells are microscopic, and they are eaten by our commensal dust mites, which are everywhere in our households and our carpeting. And you see them, actually. You do see these particles. It's your house dust. 90% of house dust is actually you, which is kind of a creepy thought at some level, but also kind of nice. It explains why, after you've lived in a place for a while, it feels like home. It is, in fact, home. And you're bathing in your own skin cells. That was a digression. It's largely a social issue in terms of personal hygiene, and that can be your armpits, or your crotch, or underneath your foreskin. And if you are a hermit or a reclusive individual and independently wealthy and therefore have no need to have other people react well with you, you probably could never clean yourself and still get by. But in general, it's encouraged that people engage in a certain amount of personal hygiene when you go off on a hike or, you know, walk the Appalachian Trail for real, then it's no big deal and you aren't going to hurt yourself if you accumulate material under your foreskin. People generally fall into the opposite era. They get obsessive about their hygiene, and that's not such a good idea because a certain amount of those secretions are necessary for healthy skin, and it becomes more easily irritated without them. I'm going to do a quick email. This one from Janet in Monterey. Janet was following up on last week's show. I listened to your advice on high-protein diets for weight loss today. I had a right hemicolectomy 3 years ago for a diverticular abscess. Eating more than a small serving of meat brings on severe pains. Poultry, especially white meat, is even worse, and fish makes me burp. I feel best when I eat mostly vegetables, beans, brown rice, and whole grains. I limit eggs and cheese because of the high cholesterol. I'm 63 and have lost a lot of muscle mass but gained weight, which is consistent with what you were saying. What diet can you recommend for me? Well, Janet, let's talk about protein sources in a second. The first thing is you had a bunch of antibiotics when you had your diverticular abscess and you had a surgery. But removing the right colon isn't going to affect your ability to absorb and digest food. I think what happened is while you were sick with your diverticular abscess, the antibiotics damaged your bowel flora, and that may have led to damage to the wall of the small intestine, or at least dysfunction of that wall. And so you are no longer excreting the appropriate digestive enzymes, and or you are no longer capable of actively transporting the amino acids because of damage to your intestine. Now, if it's problem number two, you're no longer actively transporting amino acids, you're going to need to rehabilitate your small intestine. And that's a big deal. That requires a functional medicine doctor. You know, you can come see me, you can search functional medicine on the internet and find someone who can help you with this. But before you go that far, spend a lot of money being assessed, I would start by a program of probiotics. Use over-the-counter probiotics, get something that's in the refrigerator case, get at least 15, 16 billion organisms of a variety of lactobacillus and bifidobacterium, and pick up some strong pancreatic enzymes. I prefer the ones that are animal-derived, and I think they're stronger than the vegetarian ones. And try pre-digesting your food and restoring your bowel flora, and see if that helps with your ability to absorb protein. When you do go for protein, beans and lentils, garbanzo beans, hummus, nuts, you didn't mention, but nuts are a great protein source and they don't raise cholesterol. So walnuts and almonds in particular would be useful. Fermented tofu products such as tempeh will probably be absorbed. Protein powders, maybe, maybe not, depending upon whether the problem is related to your digestive process at the front end or your absorptive process at the level of the small intestine. Also, weightlifting, 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 resistance exercise, rubber bands, because that's how you tell your body, I want more muscle, and you need to do that if you're going to keep that muscle mass after 50. Let's go now to John in Live Oak. Hello, John, and welcome to the program.
Hello, Dr. Don. Hello. I really enjoy your program, by the way.
Thanks.
Let's see, I have a relatively high cholesterol, or it's just over the border. It's like from 2 to 230. And there is, of course, a ratio. It's actually favorable in my case. I have a really high level of good cholesterol.
How high? 70s, 80s, 100, or 50?
Probably 100.
100 is great for a man. Go ahead.
Okay, so I have some friends that are taking this stuff called Cholestoff, and they got it at, it's by Nature Made. They got it at Costco.
Is that the stuff that has chitin in it?
It has a plant sterol.
Okay.
And pine tree stanol.
Okay. Those are cholesterol alcohols that plants produce for their own purposes. They seem to affect lipid metabolism. I think it's happening at the absorption level, but I'm actually not really sure what the mechanism is. You will see that in a margarine form called Benecol, B-E-N-E-C-O-L. That's a manufactured margarine made with plant stanols, which actually, if you eat enough of it, will lower your cholesterol. I don't like trans fats, so it's a margarine, so I'm not thrilled with it from that standpoint. But it does, you have some scientists behind it, so this would be an extrapolation of that concept, that these plant stanols will lower cholesterol through a biological mechanism. It doesn't matter whether you put it in a tub or put it in a pill, it's still the same concept.
So you're saying these may have fat associated with them, or no, the other might?
No, I'm saying they're fine, and they probably work somewhat.
Okay, so here's a question, basically. I'm currently taking Pravacol.
Right.
And it's a 20 milligrams tabs of Pravacol, one a day in the evening after dinner, my doctor's prescription.
Yes.
Can I take both of these, or is it being redundant?
No, they have separate mechanisms. You can take both of them. With respect to the Pravacol, if you're taking a statin, I strongly recommend you take 150 to 200 milligrams of CoQ10, which you can also pick up at Costco.
I take CoQ10.
Good. Good. That's really important. The stanols will probably give you an additional benefit. There's no reason not to try them. You can test it by simply using them and then getting another lab test after 6 weeks and see if there's been further reduction.
Yeah, great. Okay, thanks for the info. A side item here, sidebar. I was told that Pravacol is also good for prostate.
There's a study. There might
side effect.
Yeah, there's a study or maybe two looking at rates of prostate. I think it's prostate cancer, not prostate enlargement. And the thing about the statins that is often not understood is that the statins are anti-inflammatories.
Uh-huh.
So they have additional properties, and it's not established, actually, whether the reduction in heart disease from statins, if you treat 50 guys with certain criteria, you'll eliminate a heart attack. It's not entirely clear whether or not that heart attack reduction is due to the inflammatory effect, and cardiologists disagree about that, but the data would favor the anti-inflammatory hypothesis for technical reasons that I won't go into here.
Yeah.
So it makes complete sense because, you know, inflammation tends to drive forward cancers. So if you have a common cancer like prostate cancer and you have less inflammation, you'll probably have fewer cases of cancer. So
is there a downside?
Downside to taking statins is, you know, read the package insert, but essentially lowers your CoQ10, maybe has long-term an effect on association with heart failure and Alzheimer's. Certainly short-term, you have the issues of hepatitis, inflammation of the liver, and the rare but really devastating side effect called rhabdomyolysis, where for some reason your muscles just decide to melt and the broken down muscle myoglobin clogs your kidneys and puts you into renal failure. Now, that is really rare, but that's like a scary, bad, rare thing to get.
And well, that's red rice yeast or red yeast rice. Friends of mine have noticed a muscle.
Because red yeast rice is a statin.
Yeah.
So, of course, it would have those side effects. It might be slightly safer because the dose is lower, but it's still a statin, and I still tell people monitor your liver enzymes when you're on that, and take the CoQ10.
Well, you're doing a great public service. Thank you very much. Well,
appreciate your call. Have a great day.
Okay, bye-bye.
Bye-bye. And one more call before the break. Let's go to Gail in Pacific Grove. Hello, Gail, and welcome to the program.
Hi, I wanted to ask you about glucosamine. Do you recommend it for people that have arthritis?
Well, glucosamine is controversial in that some people seem to respond and others don't. And, of course, then you get into placebo, and the studies are variable. But what I can tell you is that for knee arthritis, there are convincing studies suggesting that it slows the deterioration of the cartilage in knees. And over several years' time, you can see divergence in the people who use glucosamine and those who don't on something that is fairly objective, an X-ray and a ruler with millimeter markings on it. So I feel like, given the limitations of our measurement, there's a group of people who benefit. That's what we saw in that study. In my clinical experience, people tend to fall into either responders or non-responders with respect to their pain. And some people really do seem to have pain relief from glucosamine. And then when they stop taking it, the pain comes back. And then when they restart it, the pain goes away. And those are people I really encourage to keep using it. And then I have another group who don't notice any change in their knee pain or their hand pain or whatever is the driver for the desire to treat. And I don't know what to tell them. I don't know if they're benefiting or not, because the studies that we have don't really say that. And then if you look at studies where they're just scoring pain control, glucosamine doesn't work any better than placebo. But I think that's because there's a subgroup that's responders. And if you were to first do a study where you found the responders and then you took that group and tested them against placebo, I honestly do think you would find a difference between placebo. But the implications of that beyond pain, again, hard to establish.
I had a doctor tell me, I've had both my knees replaced, so my knees are not an issue anymore, I guess.
Where are your problems then?
In my neck.
Okay, go ahead.
In my feet.
And what did your doctor tell you?
I had a doctor tell me that I was wasting my money on glucosamine and I quit taking it. Mm-hmm. And I never did notice a difference when I took it.
Okay. So the answer, I'm going to take the fifth here. I don't think we have data to tell you whether or not you would benefit.
Okay. Did I hear you say to the previous caller that statins are a factor in Alzheimer's?
There have been associational studies. I shouldn't really use the word Alzheimer's. That's unnecessarily precise. I should have used the word dementia. Mm-hmm. And there are studies showing increased dementia rates and increased progression of dementia. But that's very difficult to score. And maybe those studies don't really show anything real. You always give things a little bit of doubt. The problem with statins is that they're overused and they've become a panacea in our culture. If a person has any heart disease risk and they're not taking a statin, they're totally guilt-tripped. And what's more, their doctor is made to feel like they're being negligent. And doctors are very scared of being sued, and the easiest way to comfort yourself is to just hand out pills and let the patient decide not to take them. And then you're off the hook. But it's not a really good way to practice medicine. And I think we do our doctors a great disservice by the insurance companies sending them letters constantly saying, well, your patient isn't taking their medication, so, you know, please take care of this. At this point now, Big Brother is watching. If you're given a prescription for something, you fill it once and then you never refill it, your doctor's going to get a note from your health insurance saying, hey, your patient isn't refilling their meds. You should do something about this. With the implication that if I don't do something about this, then I'm going to be held liable by the widow because the guy went and had a heart attack and I knew he wasn't taking a statin because Blue Cross sent me a letter and I didn't have a documentation in the chart that I confronted him about not taking his statin. So therefore, I gave him the heart attack. I mean, those are the kind of wake you up at 2 a.m. weird head trips.
Those damn lawyers.
Let me tell you. We will never get healthcare costs down until we tame the pharmaceutical industry and we tame the lawyers. If we don't get our doctors out from under those two hugely influential forces, we can't practice rational medicine because rationality is systematically discouraged.
I know. It just permeates everything. It's really a shame.
Well,
I'm going to think twice about statins, too, now after hearing that.
I think that it depends on your risk. If you've had a heart attack and you're diabetic, well, for goodness sakes, your risk of having another one is so high that the risk of taking a statin is inconsequential.
Yeah.
If you're a 45-year-old male who jogs and has a high cholesterol and very healthy health habits, you don't necessarily need a statin. You might benefit, but your risk of having muscle pain is higher, and it might take us treating 50 men like you for 10 years to prevent one heart attack. And I mean, that starts to be diminishing returns big time, except for the pharmaceutical industry, where it's like, yeah, let's treat those 50. Bring it on.
Well, my doctor wants to take me off my statins, and I'm happy to hear about this. So I'm happy I heard what you had to say this morning.
Well,
very glad.
I hope you have a great day.
You too. Thank you very much.
There's never been a pill that replaced a healthy lifestyle, and there never will be. Resveratrol aside, folks, getting up, getting on your hind legs, walking or running or swimming or doing something physically with your body, eating a good diet, being moderate in terms of your alcohol consumption, avoiding crap like sodas and frankenfoods that are pushed at you. You do those things first. Then, if you still have a problem, you take a pill. I want to go to another email. This one from Gary in Soquel. Help for healing the lower esophageal sphincter and heartburn. Every night I suffer. Today I'm beginning to drink 2 to 3 glasses of Bob's Red Mill aluminum-free baking soda, which is a possible cancer deterrent. That's Gary's comment there. With water to alkalinize my system. I do not like taking ranitidine tabs, nor the aluminum chlorhydrate with magnesium from Rite Aid, nor antacids, which contain cornstarch, dextrose flavors, maltodextrin, sucrose, and artificial coloring. Wondering, Dr. Don, if Manuka honey has healing properties, and also wondering if my lower esophageal sphincter can, through proper diet and proper supplementation, be functional again. I'm careful about stress, not eating any forbidden foods such as chocolate, alcohol, tomatoes, etc. I really appreciate your show and your focus on alternative healing. Thanks, Gary, age 66, very active and fit, and massive organic veggie eater. Well, Gary, it sounds like you're halfway there. And glad to hear that you have all those healthy habits. Parsing back through your questions, honey has healing properties. It's particularly good for wound healing. When you're taking it internally, of course, it's also a sugar. And if a person is subject to insulin resistance, you can do more harm than good using honey to treat, say, an internal ulcer, because you have to use fairly large doses of it. You can't put a bandage on your lower esophageal sphincter with honey, but you can actually with something called DGL, which is deglycerized licorice. Deglycerized will not raise your blood pressure or act like spironolactone. So you can be a proactive, healthy person for your LES by using this deglycerized licorice, and I would encourage you to do that. Drinking aloe vera can also help coat irritated mucosa. Depending upon the sources of your problem, you may respond well to using betaine hydrochloride with your meals. It may bother your esophagus or it may not. You'll have to try it to see. but that can be very helpful when a person's heartburn is due to delayed gastric emptying, which is a very, very common cause of that issue. Sometimes I'll have people use a proton pump inhibitor for 7 to 10 days in order to take all of the acid away and allow their lower esophageal sphincter to heal. And then I'll have them continue with the DGL and the betaine, and they'll do very well. Sometimes using little bit of that baking soda at night at bedtime so that the dripping of acid from their stomach doesn't get into their esophagus. But those are a couple of hints for you. And if you wanted to try those and then call me back sometime with the follow-up, I'd love to hear from you, because I might have some questions that would help me target my suggestions a bit to your clinical situation, which you were a little vague about. Let's go now to Priscilla in Soquel. Hello, Priscilla. Welcome to the program.
Hi. Okay. Thank you. I'm calling with the person you just read the email from. It reminds me a little bit of what's happening. I've had a irritable bowel syndrome for a number of years, and I do pretty well, and then it flares up, and I guess in conjunction with a few things, acid reflux is also something I've been tested for, and this last month has been pretty bad. I've had a lot of problems with it, so I went to my physician and got some help from him, other than also saying that, you know, you kind of have to learn to live with it, which is really hard when it's really bad. So I've also, you know, I've been working, I'm a very healthy eater, and I'm trying to do gluten-free right now to see if that might help me. And also I do acidophilus 3.4 billion capsule type things that I take two times a day, two of them. I've also just recently been to a chiropractor who is a wellness chiropractor and deals just with natural products. And he has given me the enzymes, high-potency plant enzymes.
Okay, that's a good place to start,
yeah,
good thing to try.
To take, and I've been doing those. He said particularly with cooked meals, do those two of them before you eat a cooked meal. And just numerous things, just trying to get on top of this, because I've been pretty miserable to a point now where I'm nauseated pretty much 24/7 and not sleeping well. And I'm just looking for other information that might help me.
Well, if you have GERD or reflux symptoms, you know, belching, tasting acid in your mouth, vomity taste, heartburn, then your nausea is likely due to the inflammation of the esophagus. That is not uncommon in association with irritable bowel syndrome, mm-hmm. but I kind of approach them as two separate entities because they frequently coexist, but they don't have to.
Uh-huh.
And all of the things I said, the DGL,
right.
the aloe, the betaine with food, would be things to try for that
yeah.
end of things. Ginger can be very helpful. I didn't mention ginger, but it has direct anti-nausea properties that are central nervous system properties.
Okay.
So that would be another way of helping, but that's just covering up the symptom. It's not really going after the source.
Right.
So you don't want to do that in an isolation. Add the other things as well.
Okay.
Now, irritable bowel is a garbage bag diagnosis. It's a non-disease. And
yeah.
so it's a syndrome, which means we haven't got an identifiable disease, so we kind of throw everybody who has this in. And of course, if you read up on it, you'll see that there's two different kinds or three different kinds
yeah.
of irritable bowel. There's alternating constipation and diarrhea style, there's diarrhea style, and there's constipation style. And a couple of years ago, we had a drug for the diarrhea form. That was Lotrinox. It was a very, very effective drug. It blocked serotonin, which you'll know serotonin mm-hmm. because of antidepressants, but actually there's more serotonin receptors produced as a neurotransmitter in the intestine. It's the main organizing neurotransmitter for the intestine, actually.
Uh-huh.
So it was a serotonin, I think it was an inhibitor. It cut down on the diarrhea, but it also had like really devastating side effects, and it killed a few people. Mm-hmm. If you gave it to the wrong person, somebody with bad blood supply, it was a vasoconstrictive, and you would actually cause them to get gangrene of the intestine. So that was a big oops.
Yeah.
And of course, the drug was originally approved for one subgroup, and it came out with a warning, and people didn't read the warning, or they didn't pay attention to it and gave it to the wrong people, and then people died, and so they pulled it from the market, because it's kind of like, if we give you a toy and you don't know how to play properly with it, we're going to take it away. So you can now get that drug. The doctor has to actually take an exam to prove that they actually know how to use it, and then they'll release the drug. But Then there's Zelnorm, which came out a few years ago, and that one I think is still available. If, again, you have to jump through hoops, because guess what? That one killed people too. And this is an unpleasant disease, but it's not a lethal disease, and in fact, it's not even a disease. So if treating it with a drug that could kill you is disproportionate, to say the least. So that's the medical story, and we just basically need to take a step back and say the medical story about this is an endpoint story. It's describing the phenomenon without going out after the root. Why is the person having this excessive reaction? Why do they have so much extra peristalsis? What's the emotional component? Because clearly when you're stressed and you have chronic stress, your irritable bowel does get worse in response to that. Mm-hmm. So going after the stress piece, which you haven't mentioned, but you need to be, you know, meditating, yoga, tai chi, something every day to keep your stress level down. And if you're in a toxic relationship, you need to get out of the toxic relationship or a toxic job. And yes, if that means a financial sacrifice, well, it's that or take pills or be in pain. And so life has hard choices sometimes. But that's one thing that you can do. Another thing you can do, and you've started with the elimination of the gluten as a trial. But I would recommend eliminating across the board the, you know, 9 major food irritants and doing it in a systematic fashion and then coming back and re-challenging yourself.
Okay.
And so that's called an elimination diet. Your chiropractor person can probably work with you on that. The Institute for Functional Medicine has a lot of information about that. That's functionalmedicine.com, and they're a good place to start. The idea is, if there's something you're putting into your system that is aggravating this, you want to identify it and remove it.
Yeah.
If there's something you don't have enough of or that you need more of, you want to identify that and add it. Those basic principles are a far cry from the medical label of irritable bowel syndrome. Here's a drug that will slow down your peristalsis, which is pretty much the Western medical conventional response, and it doesn't work very well.
Yeah, I mean, I did try the things that, you know, were prescribed and just didn't do anything, seemed to get worse rather than improve anything. So I just had the one more question, because my end of it is constipation. Do you have some food source or something that I could take to help with that won't irritate? In the past, I've tried prune juice and black cherry juice and things like that, which helps me get going again, but it also gives me such terrible cramps, and I already have them. I already have that abdominal pain from
Well, what are you doing for fiber?
Well, because I'm not doing the wheat, I'm doing oats, and I'm doing other kinds of
oat bran, chia seed, non-absorbable fiber. So brands would work. Okay. Guar gum, G-U-A-R, would be one. You could probably find that at your health food store.
What is that again?
G-U-A-R. It's a goo. It'll help absorb fluid from your bloodstream and hold it in your intestine and allow things to pass.
Okay.
Since you're on the enzymes now, you might tolerate the prunes and the cherry juice better now than you did before. So that would be a thing to revisit.
Okay.
Because you may have malabsorption or maldigestion, and so that's why they didn't work before. But you can try those. Again, I would re-challenge with those.
Okay.
Let's see. Off the top of my head, I would go with fiber and make sure you're getting adequate fluids to start with. And then the problem is that if you stimulate peristalsis, you will, without having softened your stool, you'll end up making your symptoms worse.
Mm-hmm.
And the other thing I do want to point out, dairy is very common cause of symptoms, particularly cramping. And so, you know, eliminating dairy, eliminating wheat, eliminating corn, eliminating soy, eliminating citrus, eliminating peanuts and shellfish, those are kind of the ones that off the top of my head. And there may be one or two more that I'm blanking on, but those are the biggies. Getting those out of your diet for 3 or 4 weeks and then strategically re-challenging to see what aggravates your symptoms would be a good strategy.
Okay.
So good luck to you.
Thank you very much.
Bye-bye.
Bye-bye.
Off-air question. I react with congestion, sneezing, runny nose when I take probiotics that contain lactobacillus. Are the probiotics that are non-dairy just as good? Well, this is interesting, and I've never heard of this before. And to answer the off-air question, yes, the probiotics that are non-dairy, they're just not grown on a medium that contains milk, and that's the difference. But yes, they are just as good. They are the same bacteria. It's largely about the volume of bacteria. But that is interesting that you have congestion and sneezing when you take probiotics, and I'd be interested, maybe you're reacting to the capsule that it's coming in, or the culture media, but far more likely that than to the bacteria, although an allergic reaction to lactobacillus is not impossible, at least to a particular strain. Interesting question. We're going to Charles in Monterey. Hello, Charles. Welcome to the program.
Yeah, hi. How are you?
I'm good. How are you?
Great, great. Just moved back to the Monterey area. I'm 57. I'm type 2 diabetic and high blood pressure, blah, blah. I don't have insurance. I don't have a doctor. Could you lend me some suggestions? I am on a statin, though.
So this is kind of a social policy, how do I get health care when I don't have a doctor question, right?
Yeah.
Okay. You get out the Visa card or the checkbook and you pay for it is the answer. And you can buy healthcare on the open market, and I encourage people to do that rather than just sit on their hands and say, "Oh, I don't have insurance." Mm-hmm. You know, if you don't carry a collision and you on your car and you get into a car accident, you know, your car insurance pays for the dent in the other guy's bumper, and you get out the checkbook and pay for the dent in your own bumper. And, you know, that's basically it. You've got a disease that needs to be managed and the expertise to manage it's available. If you go to a private medical office, the smaller the better, and you walk up to the door and you say, you know, I'd like to know what you charge for an office visit for a cash paying customer. Most places have a rate, and by the way, that rate is fixed by the insurance companies in an indirect way. I won't get into the politics there, but just suffice to say that there'll be a asking price, and then once you're through the door, you agree to pay the asking price, and you may be held to that. Once you're through the door, you may be able to negotiate a 10 or 20% discount with the physician for prompt payment. In other words, it costs me 25 to 30% of what I charge to collect what I charge. By the time I finish paying my billing people and paying my accountant and writing off a certain amount that goes to collections. So if someone comes to me in my office and says, you know, I want a 10% discount and I'll pay you today, I'm like, that's great. You know, I'll give you 13% if you pay by check and 10% if you pay by credit card, because that's the same money. And, you know, that's the kind of thing that doctors who are independent can do. If you go to a place where it's run by, let's say, a foundation or a large corporate entity, the doctors are effectively employees and they don't have discretion. That's why you want to go to the small outfit, the mom and pop store.
Right.
And there's still plenty of those in, particularly in Monterey, but also up here in Santa Cruz. I'm one of them. So I know there are still people who actually have control over how they practice medicine.
Okay. Really good information. I appreciate it very much.
Well, you take care of yourself, okay?
Yes, I'm on it. Thank you.
Bye-bye. Let's go to Christoph in Santa Cruz. Hello, Christoph, and welcome to the program.
Hello, Dr. Don.
Hello.
I have bruised the back of my hands. Bruise easily when I bump into something.
Yeah, and you get a big purple blotch. Looks like Australia or something, right?
Yeah, yeah. It's getting a little better. I've been taking whey protein. Somebody told me that could be helpful.
Well, I don't know about whey protein, but I do have a suggestion for something I think helps with this.
Yeah.
It's topical vitamin K.
Say it again?
Vitamin K
in a cream.
In a cream.
Okay.
And if you put that on every day, when you do break a blood vessel, because that's what's happening, you're tearing a small blood vessel, and the blood is spreading out before it has a chance to clot. So if you use the vitamin K, it may be because of clotting, or it may be that it strengthens the blood vessel. I'm not really sure how it works, but it does improve that. That's an aging change that's caused by ultraviolet radiation to the skin. And it's a common aging change, and once you have it, there's no restoring you all the way back to normal, but you can minimize it by using the topical vitamins.
Okay, great. Also, I don't get enough sleep. I do walk about 2 hours every day, which may be helpful. What do you think?
Well, I think walking 2 hours a day is a great thing to be doing. It's helpful for all kinds of levels. A lot of people, when they get older, have trouble maintaining deep sleep. And part of what's going on there, and this is a hint, helpful hint for you, is that we lose our ability to create a brainwave called a sleep spindle as we get older. And women, particularly when they go through menopause, they lose their sleep spindles rather quickly.
Yeah.
And the sleep spindles are what turn off your hearing. And that means you don't get as deep because your brain is hearing more. And so using earplugs can be very helpful in people who are having trouble with sleep spindles, which I always have people
say
who are...
Say that again, sleep what?
Sleep spindles. S-P-I-N-D-L-E-S. It's when they look at your brainwaves on an EEG, there's this little brainwave that looks like a spindle, like the kind of things that people used to use to weave thread or to spin thread.
Yeah.
And so they call it a sleep spindle because it's associated with sleeping. And they've known about it for years, but only recently was it discovered that what they do is suppress your sense of hearing.
Yeah.
And when you don't have as many sleep spindles, you don't sleep as well.
Mm-hmm.
Children have tons of sleep spindles. I mean, when you raised a child, if you did, you know, you could take that four-year-old, throw them over your shoulder. You know, when they're asleep, man, they're gone.
I know.
And part of that is because of the way their brains work.
Yeah.
So earplugs, really helpful. Magnesium, which is over-the-counter.
How much?
About 150 to 250 milligrams of magnesium glycinate.
Glycinate.
Yeah, I'll spell it. Glycinate.
Yeah.
And that particular form of magnesium glycine has an amino acid in it that your brain uses to make GABA, which is one of the relaxing neurotransmitters. So not only do you get the relaxation from the magnesium, you also help build up your brain's supplies of the protein you need to build the relaxation hormone.
Okay.
So it's a double win-win. And that, at bedtime, sometimes I'll use passion flower or chamomile as well. But if you're an older male, that can backfire because they make you pee. And if you fall asleep but then have to get up 2 hours later to urinate, that's not taking you where we want to go.
Okay.
All right. Good luck to you.
Yeah. Thank you so much.
You're welcome. Have a great day.
Bye-bye.
Bye-bye. And it looks like we have time for Susan in Santa Cruz. Hello, Susan. Welcome to the program.
Hi there.
Hi.
So please, do get on. I appreciate your work and your producer. Thank you so much.
Well, thank you.
So I have an exciting, rare thing, rarish, pineal cyst.
You had an MRI.
I did.
And now
now
you're a person with a disease.
I know. Isn't that great? I'm so excited.
Yes, MRIs are notorious for that. Okay,
truly.
So why did you have an MRI?
Well, kind of multiple things. I had been having, I have migraines. Kind of low-grade migraines, and I have a history of methamphetamine abuse. I'm in recovery, and so my own perspective was, let's see if some of my cognitive stuff, some of my mental health stuff.
Now, did I give myself a lot of little vascular white matter strokes back when I was using?
Bingo. Yeah, that was my perspective, and fortunately my provider was also just thinking, well, gosh, these migraines. So I was a good candidate, and
Did you have any small white matter infarcts?
No, I'm really lucky.
Excellent.
I got out and got into recovery before I hurt myself in that way.
Good.
So lucky.
So pineal cyst, how's your sleep-wake cycle now? Are you sleeping well?
Yeah, that's a good one. Well, no.
Okay.
Some of it's behavior, you know, some of it's lifestyle.
All right. The reason I ask is that the pineal gland is very, very influential in sleep. That's where melatonin comes from. And the pineal gland has connections to the occipital lobe, so it sees light. Actually, it probably comes directly from the optic nerve, now that I think about it. Given its location, probably just pulls a thread right off the optic nerve. When light hits the back of the retina after a period of darkness, the pineal gland starts ticking like an alarm clock, and about 16 hours later, it kicks out a burst of melatonin, and that's supposed to make us sleepy and cause us to go to bed. So this kind of body clock cycle that happens, and it's entrained by light, because are left alone, if you put somebody in continuous light or up on the space station, continuous dark, we go to a 25 and a half hour cycle. So that in order to keep the 24 hour cycle, you need that light, and the pineal gland does the trick. We've screwed that up big time with artificial light and all these other things that we're doing. Worst case scenario, and I'm not a neurosurgeon, and you know my neurology background is good, but I'm not an expert on the pineal gland. But in general, a cyst is just a place where there's no brain cells. There's just fluid and a bubble. Probably congenital. In other words, your brain grew that way worst case scenario, that represents an area that got damaged and evaporated and got replaced by fluid. If the pineal gland is not completely replaced by cyst, then you've still got functioning gland there, then you are probably fine because you'll get compensatory hypertrophy. And there is all kinds of feedback loops that determine how much output of melatonin you have. That plus the other functions of the pineal gland, which I frankly can't enumerate for you, are probably going to take care of themselves. And what you have now is you have a finding on a diagnostic study which tells us absolutely nothing except that it makes you nervous.
Yeah, unfortunately, I was able to see a neurosurgeon and a neurologist. And they both
politely shrugged and right?
Well, you know, I'm going to get a follow-up MRI in a year and make sure it doesn't
grow. Make sure it's not growing, yes.
Yeah, which is, and I feel mostly stayed off the internet, so I don't scare myself to death.
Good move.
I find it fascinating, and, you know, that what I have actually gone into is some of the alternative stuff. You know, I'm curious about, you know, alternative ways to shrink cysts, you know, dissipate them, mm-hmm. you know, some seaweed stuff and other types of natural things.
Yeah, you know, the chances of any of that getting past the blood-brain barrier and into a poorly vascularized cyst at the absolute dead center of your brain is real close to low.
Yeah.
Yeah. Anyway, thank you for the call.
Yeah, thank you so very much.
Bye-bye.
Bye-bye.
We've come around to the end of another hour. And if you like that health tip of the week, let me know by emailing me at askdrdon.com. I am always interested in your feedback as well as your questions at that website. This is Dr. Don saying so long and stay healthy.